Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 17 of season 11 of Movie Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we currently are way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Banner Brothers, 5 minutes at a time, in order to begin part two of this 10-part miniseries. I am pleased to bring you an interview with Sam Edwards, an associate professor from Loughborough University, who is an expert on World War II and World War II movies. Enjoy this conversation.
Great to be here, Rob. Good. Looking forward to talking to you again.
Yeah. I am too. This is going to be fun because I know a lot about movies and TV shows and stuff that's related to World War II, but I know nothing compared to you, which is good because I get to learn new things too.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know about that, Rob. Yeah, you know a lot, so I don't know about that. But yeah.
I didn't say I don't know anything. I said I hope that you're going to be able to enlighten me with other things. And I don't even hope. I'm sure. I know that that's the way that that's going to work.
I'll do my
best. So let's just talk in general. Band of Brothers. I'm assuming you've read the book. I know that you've seen the miniseries. Probably numerous times. We talked about that when you were on, the last time. But what is your opinion overall of the historical accuracies, I guess, of this miniseries?
So I think it's a really impressive TV series. Yeah, there've been a fair few TV series over the last 4 or 5 decades or so that have dealt in some way with World War II, but I think this is up there with the very best of them. And I think of the three that are now increasingly well known, coming from Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, exploring the history of World War II. So Banner Brothers, The Pacific, and then most recently Masters of the Air. First Banner Brothers is the best of them. It doesn't get absolutely everything perfect and spot on, but it gets a fair quota of it spot on. And I think it tells a really interesting story about the experience of Easy Company as they fight their way through Northwestern Europe in 1944 and 45. So it's a cracking TV.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that from that perspective. You mostly deal with the European theater, or you deal with everything?
So my area that I work in, a couple of things. I've done a lot about D-Day and how D-Day has – the history of D-Day, but also how D-Day has been – kind of depicted in film and TV and popular culture. And the other big thing I work on is the Allied bombing campaign. So the strategic bombing campaign, the role of the US 8th Army Air Force in that campaign. So hence why I mentioned Masters of the Air a moment ago, because that's another one that I'm really interested in.
Right, obviously. And, Masters of the Air also brings up, Stalag Lift 3. So, there's the connection to The Great Escape also from that perspective. Even though I like the way they portray Stalag Lift 3 in The Great Escape much better than they did in Masters of the Air. I was like watching it, and I'm like, the camp didn't look like that. But I'm pretty sure that in Masters of the Air it was a little more accurate.
Yeah, and those kind of details kind of matter, getting the look of the thing right. And I think that's what Banner Brothers does well in each of the episodes, the look and the feel of the 1940s. I think that's one of the things they get really well get really right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Based on your knowledge of history and stuff like that, so how accurate do you think the story is here, or do they have too many, or do they take too many license with everything that's going on?
I don't think they take too many licenses. I think, there are a couple of things here and there which people have picked up on later about, you didn't get that quite right or that quite right. Things like the fact that Bly is one of the... Yeah, there you go.
I don't know how they missed that one. That's
a biggie, right? Yeah. There are things like that. But I think if you see the piece in the round and think about the episodes together and the story in its totality, I think it's well done. As I say, the look is well done, and the details in each of the episodes. Think of those incredible scenes from the early episodes as they're dropping into Normandy. You get a real sense as well in the bit immediately before they head over to Normandy of the anticipation and the tension. That was absolutely apparent in 4th, 5th June 1944. I think those kind of things, I think they get right and they handle it really well.
Oh, wow. Is most of your work based on writings, or have you also interviewed the men at the time. Obviously, you know, over time, now there are a lot less that are still around and that are probably lucid to be able to tell their story. But, you know, have you also spoken to men from then who were able to tell you their stories?
So most of my research has been looking at some of their writings and some of their oral testimonies that you can now access because they've been digitized and they're online. I did have the opportunity to talk to a couple of veterans of the 8th Air Force and back in the kind of early 2000s when I was sort of starting on some of this research. But as you say, sadly, those opportunities are now increasingly few and far between.
Right. Oh, wow. And based on their depictions or in the writing, the depiction and stuff like that. So as you said before about the anticipation and, you know, the way that the bombings went and, you know, the way that, the jumps went on D-Day and stuff like that, all that stuff from your historical research perspective, they get that all right here from that perspective?
Yeah, I think they get lots of that right. I think what Band of Brothers is really good at doing, like Saving Private Ryan as well, is kind of exploring that that human story of combat in World War II Europe. So they get the detail right, they get the aesthetic right. There's real attention to the kind of minutiae of the uniforms and the look. But I think they're also really good at giving us a sense of the fear, of the trepidation, and of the kind of the rhythms of the European conflict as well. So you've got the kind of the excited anticipation of D-Day through to the kind of the terror of dropping into Normandy, and then also the ups and downs of the campaign which unfold subsequent with those, you know, those impressive scenes at the winter fighting in Bastogne, and we get real sense. I mean, I watched the Bastogne episode and it feels cold, you know, it feels like a cold thing to just in the watch of it, just in the looking at it. And I think those are the kind of details which they handle carefully and sensitively.
Right. Okay. I mean, I've read the book Band of Brothers. I read it years ago and I reread it recently. And to me, it's very impressive the way that I mean, the book itself is not done in narrative form, and the way that they were able to translate it into, you know, this 10 part miniseries is just amazing, because they were able to flesh out all the characters based on you know, just the way that they were described and stuff like that. I mean, like, you have the whole story of you know, in the first episode about the spaghetti.
Yeah,
it's a one line thing in the book, but they create a narrative about it, and it's just you know, it to me, when someone does something like that, you think that they're going to embellish even more in the story and stuff like that, but it doesn't feel that way here.
Yeah.
It feels that they really got the tone of everything right.
Very much agree. I think that they're working with rich material in the first instance, as you say. The you know, the book's a great piece of work. Stephen Ambrose, he's a great storyteller. If it's not overly narrative, the book, you're right, but there is a really capable storyteller at work there, a really capable historian at work there. So they've got some really rich material, but one of the things they do well is adapt it into something which then also works in television. And you're right, those little details which maybe feature only briefly in the book. But then the people involved in the adaptation, the director, the producer, the writers, they've seen something there that they can work with. And and the eating of the spaghetti and then the run up the hill is one of those examples.
Yeah. It just amazes me every time to think about the way that they put that all together so almost perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, I can probably say that based on at least my knowledge of movies and TV shows, they get the whole gamut of so much that went on during the Allied campaign, because the way that this story moves along, it's not just one setting. Yeah. You know, it starts from obviously it starts from, you know, the day before D-Day, and then jumps back 2 years, and then, you know, it takes us all the way to the end of the war or beyond. Yeah. Even from that perspective. And you don't really get many narratives like that.
No,
you know, in general, you know, like, even if we're talking about the longest day, it's all one day, or it's a little more than one day, but whatever. But, you know, or a bridge too far, it's talking about one campaign, things like that. So to me, it's just amazing that they were able to, you know, take the story of the Men of Easy and, you know, tell I guess, long form narrative of what particularly happened during the course of a year, basically, because it's from June until June,
yeah,
more or less. The way that the actual story, forgetting about the flashback, during training and stuff like that. So it's 1 year basically of that, and I don't think anyone even attempted to do something like that in the past.
And... No, I think, yeah, I think they've really exploited and realized the potential of the format, which TV enables you to tell a story about World War II, which film doesn't. As you say, you've got 2 hours maybe to tell a story, and inevitably because of those constraints, the films of World War II that we think about tend to focus on a particular battle or a particular bit of a campaign. But with TV, with the multi-episode format, with the mini-series event that was Band of Brothers, they've seen the potential of that as a format and then been able to tell a really interesting story of World War II in Europe. And the way they've done so is via that human story. And they've found an easy company, a way to focus in on a select number of people and to follow them on their campaign through Northwestern Europe. And it's really well done.
Yeah. I'm more and more impressed every time I see it. And I've seen it more times than most people. And, I'm sure that there are people who've seen it many more times than I have, but I've probably seen it anywhere between 10 and 20 times over the last 24 years since it came out.
That's good going. And it set the bar so high, right? Because I think, I'll probably come back to this on a couple of occasions just because I think of the three together, but it set the bar so high. And the Pacific comes out in 2010, I think, and does a really good job as well. And I think Masters of the Air does likewise. I don't think either of those quite do it as well, though, as the first incarnation, the first instance, which is Band of Brothers. Just the material is a little bit different. There are more challenges, perhaps, in some respects with both of those series in terms of the stories they're telling. But I think Band of Brothers checks all those boxes. It does it well.
Yeah, I think also because of the characters. I mean, again, yeah. the Pacific mostly deals with four main characters. Here you're dealing with, obviously Winters is the main character, but we're touching upon all the other characters along the way and stuff like that. But you don't have to focus on nameless people. But for me, Masters of the Air, that was one of the faults, in my opinion, of Masters of the Air, that they didn't do a well enough job of developing each of the characters distinctly. Mm. From my perspective, again, I could be wrong. I've only seen it once. I do need to rewatch it. It's on my list of stuff to rewatch. The Pacific I've seen probably about 5 times. Because I love the way the Pacific is played out also.
Yeah.
But they also, you see, here they focused on one book.
Yeah.
The main information all came from Band of Brothers, the Ambrose book.
Yeah.
They might have used some stories from the other the other guys who've written memoirs like Webster and I'm trying to think of, there's a few others that had some writings that came out. But the Pacific, for instance, dealt, I think, with 3 or 4 different books because they were trying to tell an even larger story, but from different perspectives of the whole thing. I can't remember right now what Masters of the Air was specifically based on. I think it also was memoirs of various people, but I just don't think that they did the character development well enough in Masters of the Air. Even though visually it's amazing and storytelling is also amazing, but it's harder to follow the characters, in my opinion.
I think you're right. I think in Master of the Air, they don't quite flesh out the characters as well as they might have. So they're working there with it's kind of an adaptation based ultimately on a history by Donald Miller titled Masters of the Air. But you're absolutely right. They also make use of some of the memoirs of some of the individuals that then feature in the series. So one of the key characters is a guy called Harry Crosby, who's a navigator in the 100th Bomb Group. And he has published a wonderful memoir called A Wing and a Prayer back in the early 90s, 1993, I think. And it's a really good a memoir of his experiences in the 8th Air Force strategic bombing campaign. So they had some rich material there, but I think you're right. I don't think they quite developed the characters as well as they might have, certainly when you compare it to Band of Brothers.
Right. Yeah, it's one of the problems, as you said, when you set the bar so high, to be able to try to top it, And whatever. I mean, one of the things also, as I mentioned, that they take us through so many different campaigns, you know, that someone like you or I who knows a lot of movies, you say, oh, well, okay, that was featured in this movie and that was featured in this movie, but here it's put all together.
Yeah.
And it gives you more of a continuity as to, first of all, the order of how things played out, and also, you know, what happened to these specific group of soldiers, you know, and also, you know, unlike a lot of movies, when you get to know characters, usually you're going to assume that they're going to make it to the end. But here, you know, they accurately tell us what happens to the various characters along the way. Some of them could seem like prominent characters at the beginning, and then they get killed along the way, or they get injured, and then we never see them again.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that the series does really well, again, and very sensitively, I think, because we follow those characters, those individuals, those real life people through those experiences,
right.
And then there are occasions where they're lost, where they're killed in combat, or no longer get involved in the fighting because they have breakdowns. And I think the series does that
right.
Really well, handles that fact that to suffer a breakdown after weeks, months of terrifying combat was something that happened. And it was really interesting to see how Band of Brothers handled that and the individuals involved. You know, no one thought less of them from Easy Company. There was an understanding that was a right. potential consequence of weeks of combat, just like losing a leg was a potential consequence of weeks of combat.
Right. And also, I mean, I think the idea of not telling us who the people are, the talking heads at the beginning. So that also adds to it, because you don't know. I mean, obviously, once you've seen it many times, you know who they are. But you know, when you're initially watching it, you can't know who each person is, and therefore you don't necessarily know who's going to make it and who's not. So that adds to the suspense of the whole thing. It's not like they would have said right away. I mean, obviously, you know, anyone who's listening to this knows that Dick Winters made it through the end. So when they're, you know, they show interviews with Dick Winters, and you don't know it's Dick Winters, so you're like, okay, well, is Winters going to be the one to make it through or not? You know, you don't know. Because obviously they did lose commanders along the way. You know, obviously you have Meehan was a perfect example of that.
Yes.
You know, where they make us believe that Meehan is the great, you know, unifier after Sobel, and, you know, Meehan then, you know, gets killed on D-Day in his plane. He doesn't even make it out of the plane.
And you're right. And only discovering the names at the end, I think, is really powerful. And I think as well, starting each of the episodes that way, with, you know, with the camera straight onto one of the veterans of Easy, I think that was a really powerful piece of storytelling there. A really powerful piece of television. That the decision to do it like that, to start with that kind of that moment of this is the living person, is kind of a claim to authenticity, to the reality of what we're about to witness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, obviously it adds to the whole thing, the fact that, you know, we're still talking about it 24 years later, where none of these men are still around. I mean, there's not a single man of Easy Company who's still around.
Yeah.
You know, as of I think, if I remember correctly, I think 2020 was the last one of them passed away. I think so. I could be wrong about that. But again, it's been a few years since so it's good to have the living testimonies of them talking about, you know, what happened. I mean, also the interviews that we see at the beginning are snippets. They have longer interviews with all of these men, you know, which I've seen some of them, because there is a documentary that it's We Stand Together Alone.
Yes.
It's featured on the DVD set.
Yeah.
Watch it also, and it gives you more of the interviews with the men, and it talks more about the, you know, the way that they would get together every year or two, you know, to talk to other people who understood what they went through.
Yeah. It's another another sort of piece of the significance of the series, that it's a powerful story of Easy Company's World War II. It's drawing on a really rich piece of history by Stephen Ambrose, but then it itself is a really powerful historical document, because we have these wonderful interviews from the early 21st century with members of Easy Company recounting their lived experience. So in itself, as a historian, I would say it's a fascinating historical source, because it offers us that.
Right. Exactly. Again, it goes along with the fact that Spielberg knew what he was doing about making sure that he gets testimonies.
Yes.
That's what he did with the Shoah Foundation, just to get as many testimonies as possible while people were still able to still tell their stories. And it's the same idea when you're talking about Holocaust stories and stories of men who went through this type of hell, from that perspective. I mean, the Pacific does the same thing. Masters of the Air, once it came out, they no longer really had anyone to talk to.
No.
Because it was in development hell for almost 15 years or whatever it was.
But you're absolutely right. Those testimonies from that generation, so crucial then, and increasingly crucial as we get ever distant from the horrific events of the Second World War and that experience. So crucial to have those testimonies so that we can remind ourselves of what happened and what people endured and what they survived and what people didn't survive.
Yeah, that's right. And again, these testimonials from men 55 years after these events happened, it was still vivid for them to explain everything that they went through. Yeah. And I know that the writers who are adapting the story, I know that they spent hours upon hours with the men to try to make it as accurate as possible, even though, as we mentioned, there were some foibles along the way.
Nothing's perfect, right? Nothing's perfect. No, and at the end of the day, it's a bit of storytelling, but it's
good storytelling, but it's disappointing finding out that they screwed up something so big.
The Blythe thing is a real biggie.
Exactly. I'm sure that there are other minor things here and there, but when you're talking about big stuff, the disappointment.
Whether something is
So the way that they depict D-Day and the way that they depict the battle at Manor Court and all that stuff, from your research, do they depict it properly?
I think ultimately, yeah, they do. When I watch something like Band of Brothers and I think about the first episode, as they head into Normandy, one of the things I do, the first and second episodes as they fight in Normandy, one of the things I think about is how does that sit next to some of the other depictions of that momentous event that are out there in popular culture. And we've already talked briefly about one, Longest Day. You and I have talked at length about another one, Saving Private Ryan. I think of some of the other films. I think The Big Red One in the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. D-Day, 6th June 1944.
Right, but The Big Red One dealt more with the African campaign, or Italy.
It did deal more with that, but it does also have some scenes in Normandy as well. If you watch it now, there's an interesting kind of parallel at work in terms of how the Big Red One depicts some of that, and also how The Longest Day does it 20 years prior. There's the classic film from the mid-1950s, D-Day, 6th June 1944. There's a bunch of them out there. Look at it in the round like that, though. I think those first couple of episodes of Band of Brothers are really interesting. One, because they foreground the paratroopers, the airborne troops, which do absolutely feature in Longest Day, the famous scenes at St. Mary's. But I think they really zero in on that and give us a sense of what it was to be flying in those C-47s, those Dakotas, as the flak is throwing its on its way to them heading into the sky. So I think they handle that really well, and also that sense, as we've already talked about today, of just the sheer kind of intense build up to Operation Overlord, to the Normandy invasion, to the kind of the trepidation beforehand, and then the release as the operation is underway, and then what follows afterwards, and the fighting around taking that gun emplacement. I think that's really nicely done.
Right. I mean, again, as we know from the end of part two, you know, they still teach that, or at least at the time, they were still teaching that in West Point. You know, so I don't know if 25 years later they're still doing that. My assumption is that they are. Yeah, you know? But I
wouldn't be surprised. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, it's textbook stuff. And certainly I know that, you know, from friends that or contacts that you work in U.S. Army War College and stuff. Yeah, they do staff rides out to Normandy still and go to these sites. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's still taught.
Well, all right. So is there anything else you want to bring up about the connections between Band of Brothers and history?
So I guess one of the other things we could talk about here is Band of Brothers comes out at a really interesting moment. It airs originally in September of 2001, right? Mm-hmm. And that month where the horrific events in New York and elsewhere with the attack on the Twin Towers. It's that month that the Band of Brothers is aired in the first instance. It's come in, what, two or three years after Saving Private Ryan, 1998. Mm-hmm. So as a historian of World War II, but also a historian of World War II and its memory and its legacy, that's a really interesting thing that it's coming out at that moment. And various scholars have talked about one way to think about things like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers is that they are being produced and they're being aired at a moment in time where on both sides of the Atlantic, Americans, Britons, Canadians are being asked and invited to think about the fact that World War II is now drifting into history. It's moving away from living connection with the past. It's drifting into history. And it's a moment in time where on both sides of the Atlantic, an idea of World War II has kind of emerged and consolidated. And it's the idea of ultimately World War II as inverted commas, the good war. And this is a phrase which ultimately goes back to a really powerful piece of oral history by an American historian called Studs Terkel, which is published in 1985. The book is called The Good War, with good war in inverted commas, because he's not saying it's a good war. He's saying that there's an idea of the conflict. So Studs Terkel, 1985, The Good War. And subsequent to that, various historians have explored that idea. Why is it that in the US, the UK, Canada, or other places as well, why is it that in the late 90s, early 21st century, there's this kind of intense interest in World War II? And why is it that there's this idea of it as the Good War? So if your listeners are interested, a recent book on this is by the historian Elizabeth Sammet. And her book is titled Looking for the Good War. And it's a really, really interesting read, which will give you another kind of angle on thinking about Band of Brothers and when it comes out.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and again, obviously they weren't aware at the time, when they were making it, they didn't know what was going to happen when it was going to be aired. You know, that type of thing. Like have you ever seen the movie The Last Castle with Robert Redford and...
Yes, and James Gandolfini.
Gandolfini. Right. So I happened to love that movie. I love the way that it depicts things. I'm trying to remember the name of the director, Rod Lurie. Rod Lurie did it. I've listened to the commentary, and apparently the day that they were doing the score was 9/11, and so listening to the score of that movie, by thinking about the fact that it was done on 9/11, makes it even crazier to think about it, because it's a very patriotic score and stuff like that.
I
don't know at what point during the day. I mean, obviously 9/11 started early, so I don't really know, you know, how that really fits in, because I don't think people were that detached that they were still working on a score at that time. But little things like that, you find out later that, you know, when things happen and how they, how they connect and stuff like that. So again, with this, you know, you're mentioning the fact that everyone thought that, okay, World War II is not as interesting as it used to be. And now we're going to move on to other things. And then boom, you know, you get something new to start talking about. And then you start the whole comparison between this war and that war and what's different and what's the same. Yeah. And, you know, even though everyone who's fighting the war are the same, you know, you have the same, it's a different generation, obviously, but it's the same age group of people that you're saying, okay, how do soldiers depict, soldiers who fought during World War II as opposed to soldiers who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that, you know, that type of thing. So it is very amazing to think about it from that perspective.
And those overlaps, yeah, between past and present, because what we think about the past, about historical events, is partly shaped by the moment that we live in, the experiences that we encounter, the things that are happening in the world, and at the same time, how we understand the world and how we think about the challenges that that we confront in our moment is in turn shaped by our understanding of history and the past. And so the fact that the late 90s, early 21st century, both sides of the Atlantic, there's an intense interest in World War II, tells us something about that moment and also helps us to understand, you know, some of the ways in which us, the earlier versions of us there in the early 21st century, kind of responded to those challenges and were shaped by them. And there are these fascinating parallels and crossovers. The other one that comes to mind for me is, you know, it's the summer before 9/11 that Pearl Harbor, that film, is released. And as soon as you know that, as soon as you understand that in the summer of 2001, which is, of course, an anniversary year for Pearl Harbor, in that moment, there's a lot of attention being given to the attack on 7th December 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. Since you know that, then it helps us to understand why perhaps one of the ways in which various newspapers in the States reported on the attack on the Twin Towers was to make reference to kind of that, or to use that as a reference point almost. So there are newspaper and front covers from, you know, the days after 9/11, where it is described as a day of infamy, which is, of course, right, the famous language used by Franklin Delano Roosevelt on his 8th December 1941 address to Congress. And so they got a moment where a trauma from history, an attack from history, is being used as a means to kind of make sense of a trauma in the present.
Right. Do you think that you can make that comparison, that they're both days of infamy, but it's just for different generations?
I think there is something in that comparison which makes sense. I think these are different events; their consequences are different, but there is something of a parallel there. At least that's how some contemporaries certainly felt it. That there was something of a parallel there.
Right. See, I look at it from the perspective that because of the differences in social media and the way that media worked between, you know, the 60 years between 1941 and 2001. So, people back in 1941, when they were hearing about Pearl Harbor, they were either hearing about it on the radio at the time or afterwards. But 9/11, we all, you know, any of us that were old enough, we were living through it. You know, we were watching it as it was happening.
Yeah, you're right that that's a key difference in terms of how things are experienced. There's an immediacy to how things are experienced in the 21st century because of 24-hour news channels and now, of course, social media as well. Yeah,
right. And obviously, 25 years on, it's even greater the way that you watch something on the news and you see. I always remember I used to laugh at the fact that my grandfather would watch the news and he would want us to be quiet when the news of the next hour came on, even though he'd been sitting and watching the news for the last hour, you know. And so I was like, oh, come on, how much could really have changed within an hour? But nowadays, the news from an hour ago is not as relevant as what's happening right now.
You know, so
it's cyclical from that perspective. Mm. Yeah. All right. Excellent. Is there anything else you want to bring up?
One other thing that I'll briefly mention here. So it's one of the other things I think the Band of Brothers series does well, although it's quite brief in the series, but when it does it, I think it does it well, is tell us something about the impact of the American military in World War II England. Because we do have a handful of scenes of the paratroopers in England as they're preparing for D-Day and as they come back between operations. And I think that's a really interesting bit of the story told here as well. And by By the spring of 1944, just before D-Day, there is something in the region of 1.5 million American service personnel in the British Isles. And the vast majority in the south, understandably, because they're getting ready for Operation Overlord. There's also about 400,000 or so in eastern England, which is where the 8th Air Force is based. And in the county that the 101st Airborne Division is based in, which is Wiltshire. So 101st Easy Company spent some time at Aldbourne in Wiltshire. So by April of 1944, in just that one English county, Wiltshire, there is something in the region of 135,000 American GIs, and that's a profound moment in the history of England, in British social history. This is the kind of the first big encounter between Americans and Britons of the mid 20th century, and it's a huge moment, and it's still remembered. The one of the pubs that the Easy Company guys used to use in Aldbourne now has a plaque on its exterior, kind of remembering that fact. And just the summer just gone, a UK TV series called Time Team, which is an archaeology program. They did a special issue, I think a couple of special editions, titled Digging Band of Brothers. And they went back to Aldbourne and they did these archaeological digs in the village to uncover where Easy Company was based, where their huts were, where their encampment was. And part of the project as well, really interestingly, involved UK and US veterans, as in veterans from the last 20 years or so, involved in the archaeological dig. So it's a really interesting bit of history there. And I think you can probably check it all out on YouTube. You go onto YouTube and look for Digging Band of Brothers, a couple of really interesting episodes there following Easy Company's legacy in Aldbourne, England.
Oh, wow. That's really, really cool. Wow, this has been so fascinating. As I told you at the beginning, I knew that you were gonna, enlighten me on things that I didn't know. So there you go. So I appreciate that. All right. You want to let people know how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. Yeah. So you can find me on Blue Sky. As the running historian. You can also find me online as the running historian as well. I've got a website because, amongst other things, I do a lot of running. And you can track me down via where I work as well. I'm an associate professor of history at Loughborough University in the UK.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movearound.net. So I will be back tomorrow with another guest as we continue to make our way through this entire mini-series. Thank you very much for joining me once again, Sam.
Absolutely, always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. So until tomorrow, Curry.
Curry.